Hello. Good afternoon. So we're just about to start the 3:45 seminar, so if you don't want to stay for the seminar, then you can skulk out. That's fine. Great. Who's got a Bible with them? Great. That's enough to kind of make it work. Okay, cool. So just a bit of an introduction. My name's Robbie. I actually used to work for Soul Survivor. So up until February, I used to work for Soul Survivor. Now I don't. But I'm back to do a seminar. So it's great to be here. And when I was 14 years old, I managed to get stuck in a child's swing in a play park. You know the ones with the bars across the top with a bar down the middle? I managed to get stuck in a child's swing. And then, very much like now, I'm kind of asking myself the question, how did I end up here? I don't usually do this sort of stuff. The job that I used to have at Soul Survivor, I used to be the events manager, so this sort of stuff wasn't really in my remit. So this is actually the first seminar I've ever done. So thanks very much. We'll see if you're still clapping at the end. Basically what we're going to look at today is I'm going to let you know now, it's probably going to be about 25 minutes to half an hour. You can ask questions at the end. Yeah, good whoop for that. You can maybe ask questions at the end if you want. I might not have the answers, but feel free to ask questions. Okay, so while I used to work for Soul Survivor, there's three things that I learned from Mike. One of them is that he's very good at cooking lamb. One of them is that he has an absolutely awful sense of fashion. And the other one is probably the most important thing, which is that if you want to disciple people, then sharing your faith with them is a really important tool that you have at your disposal. So that's what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about discipleship. I want to talk about sharing your faith. And we're going to look at that through the Gospel of Mark. So if you've got your Bibles, open them at Mark. I'll tell you where to look in a minute. But the first question is, why are we looking at Mark? What is so significant about the Gospel of Mark? Well, Mark is entirely different to all the other Gospels. I mean, they're all different, but Mark is kind of different on a different level. It still focuses on the life of Jesus, but it's very diverse. Firstly, we need to understand that Mark wasn't written for people who understood Jewish cultures or traditions. It was written for probably a Roman audience. So you've got to bear that in mind when you look at Mark. And if we were comparing the Gospels to kind of literary terms, like when you were at school, you learn literary terms like adjectives, pronouns, nouns. Mark would definitely be a verb. It's the idea of everything's a doing, everything's an action, everything's always happening, nothing is standing still, it's always action. And sometimes you read the Gospel of Mark and you think sometimes it's just a real kind of whistle-stop tour of the life of Jesus. So you look at Luke. At the start of Luke, he gives us the whole backstory. He gives us the whole backstory of Zechariah. Matthew gives the whole genealogy all the way back to Abraham. John takes it even further back, all the way to the kind of start of time. But Mark starts with a prophecy from Isaiah and then is smack bang at the start of Jesus' ministry. And the way that I kind of look at it is if the gospel writers were your grandparents, then, and they were at a family occasion, Luke would be giving you the story of how your grandparents met. Matthew, he would be taking the family tree out, taking it all the way back to where it all started. John would get out a slideshow and a projector and take it back to how everything started at the beginning of time. And Mark would be the type of grandparent who wasn't really interested in anything you've done until you graduate university. Anything up until then is really unimportant. And Mark, so that's kind of where Mark starts off. He starts off at Jesus' ministry. And we've got to look at the way that Mark writes his gospel. So we look at his writing style. I will happily buy anyone a coffee. In fact, I'll buy anyone and their table a coffee if someone can tell me what the word euthios means. Euthios. Don't Google it. No Googling. If you Google it, you're out. Anyone. E-U-T-H-E-O-S. No. This is fun, isn't it? No. One more guess. Right, no, doesn't mean any of that. It basically means straight away or immediately. So, if someone wants to turn away, we're looking at the first chapter of Mark. If someone can look at verse 10, if someone can look at verse 12, if someone can look at verse 19 and 20, you don't have to read them out. I just want you to kind of turn to them. We've got verses 21, we've got verses 29, we've got verses 31, and we've got verses 43. So we start in first chapter of Mark. This is just right where it all kicks off. Verse 10, it says, "And straight away coming up out of the water, he saw the heavens open and the spirit like a dove descending upon him." Verse 12, it says, "And immediately the spirit drove him into the wilderness." Verses 19 and 20 talks about James and John and Jesus meeting them, and it says, "And straight away he called them." And then verses 21, it says, "Straight away on the Sabbath day he entered into the synagogue and taught." It carries on and it carries on and it carries on. Basically, throughout the whole of Mark, this word, euthios, which means straight away or immediately, is mentioned no fewer than 40 times. And it doesn't just give us an idea of the way that Mark writes his gospel, but it gives us the way of how Jesus served during his ministry, or how Mark thought that Jesus served during his ministry. So we pick things up throughout Mark as we go along, and it really builds a picture of how we see Mark seeing Jesus. And if we compare it to how John sees Jesus, then we see two very different pictures. The first, almost one of the first things that John describes Jesus as is he describes Jesus as the Word, whereas Mark describes Jesus as a carpenter. Now, both are true, but both give a very different idea of how each writer is describing Jesus. John focuses on Jesus having this sort of eternal presence with God from the very start of time. He's described him as the Word, whereas Mark is describing what his job is. Now, if you can imagine that there's a car accident on the road, two cars bump into each other, and you've got two people who witness it. One of them is a 50-year-old man, and one of them is a 10-year-old boy. The 50-year-old man gives his statement to the police and says, "It was an Audi and it was a BMW. Let's face it, it's always a BMW. So it was an Audi and a BMW. They shunted into each other. The 10-year-old gives a statement to the police and he said it was a red car and a green car. Both statements are entirely true. And they can both be true without making the other one false. So I think when we look at the Gospels, it's very important that because we read Luke and because we read Matthew, Mark and John, we can read them and we can accept them as true without making any of the other Gospels false, even though they're coming from different points of view. They just highlight different characteristics of Jesus. Anyway, John describes him as the Word, and Mark describes him as a carpenter. Mark focuses on what Jesus' job was. He focuses on what he did with his hands, what he did for a trade. Effectively, it was kind of what was Jesus' kind of 9-to-5 job. It's a very hands-on job. It's very much looking at the human aspect of Jesus. And Mark seems to have this kind of pattern of writing throughout his whole gospel. I mean, we've got to ask ourselves the question, what does it actually matter what Jesus did for a job? Like, if you're talking about Jesus as being the savior of the world, what does it matter that he was a carpenter? But Mark sees this as a really important thing to kind of pick out. I think we need to look at also the character that is brought out in Mark. So we look at the character, and something that's linked in a key way to character is emotion. And so we look at how Jesus is described throughout Mark. So we look at Mark 3, verse 5. I'm going to nip through these so you don't need to kind of look them up. But he's asking questions of the Pharisees. And then we see that Jesus gets angry and he says, he looked around at them in anger, deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts. And it might think, well, did Jesus really get angry? But we hear stories of him turning the tables over in the temple. And if we believe that Jesus is fully man and fully God, being fully man means you experience everything the emotions and the feelings of a man. And we look further on and we see that when Mark deals with the story of the leper, we see Jesus' compassion. And it says that, moved with pity, he stretched out his hand and touched him and said, I will be clean. And then we see Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. And we see that the real kind of human sadness that Jesus experiences. And it says he took with him Peter, James, and John and began to be deeply troubled and distressed. And he told them, my soul is consumed with sorrow to the point of death. And then he tells them to stay here and keep watch. In these short passages, we get a real insight into what Mark seems to think is important about Jesus. If you were to read John, you get the idea that it's this sort of very much a bird's eye view of things. You see Jesus in everything that he is. It talks about Jesus being the Word. It takes him away from being a man. It takes him back to being there at the start of everything. But Mark seems to be really interested in what it means for Jesus being fully man and fully God. And Mark's way of talking about kind of human nature and human character, it's not just extended to Jesus. It also goes to the disciples. And he is actually pretty scathing of the disciples. He talks of their human failure. He talks of their incomprehension. They can't understand what Jesus is saying. They always misunderstand things and are always confused. In Mark 8, we pick this up. And it's the disciples are on the boat after feeding the 4,000. And the disciples ask for a sign and Jesus rebukes them. He says, aware of their discussion, Jesus asked them, why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Or are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? And don't you remember? I mean, you can see why Jesus is angry about this, because they've just come from feeding 4,000 people. And the guys are like, right, you've got to show us a sign. And he's like, I've just fed 4,000 people. They're like, yeah, but show us a sign. And he's like, I've just fed 4,000 people. You can tell why he gets frustrated. And then later on, there's always this really kind of famous rebuke of Peter. Now, Peter is an interesting character. There's a quote which says that over 50% of the times that Peter is mentioned in the Bible, he's either just done, is currently doing, or is about to do the wrong thing. And so Jesus kind of gets really frustrated. He's like, oh, come on, Peter. And he snaps at Peter and he says this kind of famous rebuke of kind of, get behind me, Satan. He said, you do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. Now, if Jesus said that to you, that would be a massive kick in the teeth. But I think if we look over that and we look at the way that Jesus dealt with the other disciples, it's just as harsh. So it says in Mark 10, that like James and John have just heard Jesus talking about how he's going to die fairly soon. And they're both squabbling about who's going to sit at the left and who's going to sit at the right. It's like telling someone that you're going to die and they're saying, can I have your TV? It's like, it's that thing of, oh, hang on guys, there's a bigger picture at play here. And I think what we've got to look at is, we've got to look at it and say, well, why is it that Mark has this sort of fascination with everything to do with the human character? And why, when it comes to disciples, it almost seems that he kind of holds them in a higher regard, or he holds them to a higher standard than the other writers? Or is it that there is just a different purpose to Mark explaining the human nature of Jesus and the human nature of the disciples? I think if we sum it all up as that, and we sum it all up with a simple explanation that Mark's gospel just picks out human aspects of Jesus' character, then I think we've fallen really short of the mark. I think we do his gospel a real disservice and a big injustice. I think if we revisit the rebuking of James and John in Mark 10, I think we see a kind of further purpose for the gospel. It goes on into verse 38. It says, you do not know what you are asking. Jesus said, can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? There's a sentence, baptized three times. He says, we can, they answered. Jesus said to them, you'll drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I am baptized. Yeah, whatever that is. Someone's clearly on a word count to see how many times they can get baptized in there. But yeah, you kind of look at it, you think in rebuking the disciples, Jesus is actually, he's showing them what it truly means to be a disciple. He's showing them that it's important because being a disciple is important. He's showing them that what they do matters because being a disciple matters. He's bringing them back to what it means to serve and what it means to be a follower. I think, and this is my personal opinion on this, I think Mark writes about human nature and points out the failures of the disciples because only in explaining human nature and human failure can Mark make discipleship accessible. I'm going to explain what that means. It's the idea of if we see the disciples as being these perfect people, then we will never attain that level. But actually what Jesus shows, what Mark shows them as, is actually he shows out their human failures. He shows that they get things wrong, that they misunderstand, that they don't actually get a lot of what Jesus is talking about. But Jesus still used them. And I think when we view Mark, the Gospel of Mark, not as a beratement of the disciples, but more as a kind of a guidebook of discipleship, I think we kind of see things in a very different light. Does anyone here still do the hokey cokey? Do you know the hokey cokey? I'll not get you to do it because I think you'll all walk out. Yeah, you know the hokey cokey. I've got two children, and I've got a 1.5-year-old and a 3.5-year-old, but we haven't quite got onto the singing the hokey cokey at birthday parties yet. It's more just fighting over toys and crying. And that's just the parents. There we go. That's the only joke you're getting. But as bizarre as it sounds, and this is going to sound incredibly bizarre, I think when we look at Mark's gospel, we understand that actually the hokey cokey is what it's all about. Stick with me on this one. It's tenuous, but stick with me. There's a pattern. There's a pattern all the way through Mark's gospel. And he threads it throughout his whole gospel. And it's actually, if you kind of pick up on it, you can see it throughout the whole thing. And it's a pattern that when we properly understand it, it really does kind of inform our attitude as to what it means to be a disciple. Gives us a blueprint of how we should be. And it really gives us a hope that things are going to turn out all right. Believe it or not, the hokey cokey is at play all the way through Mark's gospel. It really is. It's the pattern of sending out and drawing back in. It's the pattern of going out, coming back in. If you think of a fisherman, he casts his net out and he draws it back in. If you think about the tides go out, the tides come back in. I'm sure Einstein said for something like, for every action, there's an opposite reaction. There we go, something like that. I don't know, I didn't do science, clearly. But yeah, we look through the entirety of Mark's gospel and we see this pattern at play the whole time. If we start again at the top, Mark 1, it says, we looked at earlier, the beginning of the gospel is commonly known as John the Baptist preparing the way for Jesus. So right at the start of Mark's gospel, like point 1, word 1, title 1, Mark's gospel begins with the sending out of someone. John is sent out to prepare the way for the coming of Jesus. And if we look throughout Mark's gospel, the sending out just continues. It just continues throughout the whole thing. Like Jesus calls his first disciples and tells them, I will send you out to fish for people. And shortly after, or immediately, as Mark would say, Jesus appoints his 12 disciples. And it says, Jesus went up on a mountainside and called to him those he wanted, and they came to him. He appointed 12 that they might be with him and that he might send them out to preach and have the authority to drive out demons. They were appointed with the purpose of being sent out. And Jesus is very deliberate throughout all of Mark's Gospels of sending the disciples out before him. So it starts with him sending John out, or starts with God sending John out to prepare the way for Jesus, and it just carries on. And as we get to chapter 6, we see that Jesus, he sends out the 12 disciples. He sends them out in pairs, and it says that they went across the land preaching the gospel, driving out demons, doing all this sorts of crazy stuff. So we can tell from this that when Jesus calls his disciples, he sends them out and stuff happens. And we've got to think that's what it means to be a disciple. Correct. Wrong. That's part of what it means to be a disciple. If we look at it, if we go back to the hokey cokey, and I know this is a tenuous link, but it is a tenuous link. But basically, if we say that being sent out is just one part of what it means to be a disciple, the pattern we see at play in Mark suggests there's another equally important part of being a disciple. It's the drawing back in. It's the return leg of the journey. Whatever you want to call it, it's the in of the hokey cokey. You've been out, then you're coming back in. And again, this is demonstrated all the way through Mark's gospel. Most notably, it's in all the areas that we have seen Jesus sending out his disciples. They are sent out, but only after they've been called in, after they've been drawn into his presence. He calls the first disciples to follow him. He calls the remaining disciples to join him. And we see in chapter 6, it says he only takes with him those that he wants. It is a purposeful and really deliberate drawing into a more concentrated presence of Jesus. And it's one that only he and the disciples experience. In short, the disciples can't be sent out until they've been drawn in. And you cannot be drawn back in until you've been sent out. The two parts of the cycle can't exist without the other. If you imagine trying to do the hokey cokey where all you do is go in, you're just going in and in and in and in. Or you're going out and out and out until you're miles away. It's all about the in of the hokey cokey and the out of the hokey cokey. And I mean, to remain close to Jesus would have been all that the disciples would have wanted. And you can't really kind of blame them for that. To spend all your time in the presence of Jesus sounds perfect. But to remain close and never be sent out, that was never the plan. If you remember the story of the Transfiguration, they go to the top of this mountain and they see this vision at the top of the mountain, and it's the most glorious vision. And it's Peter, putting his foot in his mouth. But he's like, great, we're going to build tents. We're going to do all this stuff here. We're just going to stay here forever. And they're like, no. Like, you've got to go down the mountain. It's that thing of staying in the presence of Jesus is all the disciples wanted to do. But that isn't what it means to be a disciple. If you remember when you learned to ride a bike, I'm assuming you all have learned how to ride a bike. True? Me? When you learn how to ride a bike, you'll never learn how to ride a bike and you'll never master the skill while the parent keeps a hold of the seat. It's only when the parent pushes you out that you actually learn how to do it. Like, to remain close and never be sent out would not be what it means to be a disciple. Similarly, to be sent out and never be drawn back in, it breeds a real disconnect. It breeds a separation and a real divide between Jesus and the disciples. Practically, being drawn back in, it kind of maintains the relationship that otherwise kind of distance and time would damage. Being drawn back in also ensures the kind of purity of the message being shared. Is anyone into history? Woo! Yeah, three of you. Wicked. I love history. Not really important why, but I love history. One of the people that I think is really good is Alfred the Great. Not is, was, he's dead. But Alfred the Great was brilliant. I think aside from all the stuff that he kind of fighting battles, killing Vikings, all that sort of stuff, one of the things that he did was he got people to learn language, which is fantastic. He got people to learn how to write. He was an advocate of children having an education, which is something that didn't actually happen for another 1,000 years. But one of the things that he did was he got people to sit with him, and they spent time with him before they then went out. Because if people can't read and people can't write, then you need to rely on what people are telling you. And the way that he got people to rely on what was being told to them was by having the people that were telling those stories spend time with him. The same applies to Jesus. The more time that the disciples spent with Jesus, the more they were equipped to go out and talk to people about him. If you don't spend time being drawn back in, how do you actually know who it is that you're talking about? But most importantly through all of this is that actually to live in an attitude of closeness and distance, of going out and being drawn back in is exactly how Jesus lived his life. In Mark, there's a number of examples of Jesus just disappearing on his own. Just goes off, just by himself. Goes away from the crowds to try and find a place of silence and solitude. And the purpose for Jesus is exactly the same as it was for the disciples. When he goes out and he's sent by the Father to go out. And when he draws back in, he's drawn back into the presence of the Father. The hokey cokey only works when you put a leg in and you take a leg out, or an arm in or an arm out, or your whole self or your whole self. It cannot exist without both parts. In the same way, discipleship cannot exist without going out and coming back in, or being brought in and then going out. And I think when we see this at play in the Gospel of Mark and we look at this, then we can start to kind of ask ourselves questions. What are we doing? What are we doing as disciples of Jesus? Do we spend all our time, someone's clearly scored a point, do we spend all our time in the presence of Jesus? Not that that's wrong, but actually as disciples we're called to go out. Are we too afraid to go out? Are we afraid of what's going to happen? Or are we too far going out that actually we're not redrawing and withdrawing back into the presence of Jesus to be re-energized, to be revitalized, to be renewed and refreshed? Towards the end of Mark's Gospel, we get to Palm Sunday. Now, Palm Sunday marks Jesus' entry into Jerusalem. It's in Mark 11, if you want to read it. But Jesus sends out his disciples for one of the last times. He sends them out to prepare the way. And this is a key part because actually this is Jesus' life kind of coming full circle. We began with Mark's Gospel of John the Baptist preparing the way. And then kind of at the apex or the high part of the story, we see the disciples again going ahead to prepare the way for his arrival. Now, by now, the disciples, they've spent a lot of time with Jesus. They've seen him heal people. They've seen him rebuke people, encourage people, teach people. And they've been sent out and they've been drawn back in multiple times. And it's all in preparation of kind of what is to come. The following week, the disciples would see a break in this pattern. Having been sent out to prepare the way, they then wouldn't be drawn back into the presence of Jesus, into his physical presence, until he had completed everything he was sent to do. Now, this really messed with the disciples. Like, they've had Jesus so present for such a long time. They based their lives around this pattern, and suddenly he wasn't there. Now, you've got to remember as well that the disciples weren't, I don't think it's being unkind to say they weren't always the sharpest tools. Some of them literally thought that Jesus was this sort of military leader who was going to come back and smite the Romans and take back Jerusalem. And there's an argument to say that that's exactly what Judas thought. Judas, if you look at Judas, potentially there's a thread that Judas was part of the Iscari tribe or this Iscari group of people who were really thought that Jesus was this military leader who was going to take back Jerusalem. Anyway, that didn't happen. And so they're scared. They don't know what's happening. Their whole lives are kind of thrown into a mess. Peter completely loses it again. And it's like, do you know Jesus? No, never met him. Never, ever, ever met him. Now the whole project that Jesus and the disciples they've been working on is kind of thrown into the air. Is this even going to work? What do they do now? Jesus isn't here. And this isn't made any better by reading the end of Mark's Gospel. But I think it kind of follows suit beautifully with everything that Mark's already written. So the bit at the end, it goes, do not be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth who was crucified. He is risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him, but go. Tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him just as they told you. And then this last bit is brilliant. And they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had seized them, and they said nothing. Which isn't really a message of hope at the end. But the key part of that is that Mark ends with the instruction, go. He's like, the time of preparation is finished. That's done. Like, the time of tutelage is over. This is where discipleship matters. It's in the going. It's in the telling. in the sharing and in the coming back into the presence of the one who sent you. Just that bit where it says, but go, tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you to Galilee. Yeah, there you will see him, just as he has told you. Go, there you will see him, just as he has told you. When I started this seminar, I said that working with Mike had taught me three things. And as much as I love his cooking, and as much as I admire his sense of fashion, they're not the things that are really applicable here. However, as I read more and more of Mark's gospel, the more and more I'm convinced that mission and discipleship shouldn't be separated. And as we found through looking through the gospel of Mark, and I hope that you'll find as you kind of look deeper into the gospel of Mark, is that all this boils down to is kind of mission and discipleship. Like the disciples, they were all thrown in at the deep end. They were completely out of their depth, underprepared, scared of what might happen, anxious about people's responses and about what they might have to say. And for some of you, this might sound really familiar. Telling people about Jesus can be really scary, like really scary. I flew here this morning and I basically printed this talk on paper that my grandmother would say this font was too big. But I sat there and I sat in between two people. There he is. There we go. Which one's the big top and which one's Mike's shirt? If he says anything, I didn't say that. I really didn't say that. I just love this really, really colourful shoes as well. Yeah. It's like the Wizard of Oz. Where were we? Yeah, I flew here this morning. I sat in between some guy who was clearly on the way to a very important meeting and some other guy who was clearly just coming back from a very important meeting. And I had this talk in front of me. And first off, I was kind of like, I was trying to make notes. I made notes as I've gone. And I'm trying to make notes on this thing. And I'm trying to kind of hide this thing away because I'm thinking, I don't want anyone to ask me what it is that I'm writing here. Don't want anyone to like read that I've got Jesus written on a piece of paper. I was just trying to keep it secret. And I thought, you know what? What does it matter? And so I just kind of started writing my notes. And the guy next to me kind of, he did ask what I was doing. And it was an opportunity. It was an opportunity to share what it was that I was writing. It was an opportunity to share something of my faith. I don't know whether that's going to go anywhere. But actually, it was that level of fear of me thinking, how is this person going to respond to what I'm going to say? So the disciples, they were thrown in at the deep end. They didn't know what was going on. You might feel that you're thrown in at the deep end. You might be the only person you know who's a Christian. You might be the only person in your school, your class, your, I don't know, football team. Don't know why that was funny. But I've just started a new job in February. I started a new job and I started commuting to London. And when I started, I prayed a prayer that scared the life out of me. And I prayed that God would use me in the time that I was commuting to tell people about him. For 7 years, I've been driving into work, been driving by myself. I don't have to talk to anyone. And it's been wonderful. Just sit by myself, get to work. Yeah, fine. Now I'm in a position where I'm on this hot, smelly train. And I'm surrounded by people that I don't know. But I was very determined to say, no, I'm going to pray that God's going to use me in this situation. And there's been a handful of times that I've actually probably plucked up the courage to say something. I've definitely bottled it more times than I've done something about it. But what I've found is that actually being faithful to God's prodding and his nudging and telling people about what Jesus has done in my life has made my faith in him more alive than it's been in years. And that's the mission and the discipleship bit. If we want to improve as disciples and we want to get better at being disciples of Jesus, then what we need to do is we need to start telling people what Jesus has done in our lives. That's what the disciples did. They weren't skilled people. They were ordinary guys with ordinary jobs, ordinary lives. Mark says they weren't the sharpest tools in the shed. My dad would probably point out that they'd be the type of people who would lose the plot in a children's story. You know what? They remained faithful. They remained obedient. And they used what God has done in their lives to tell people about him. And it doesn't matter that we are ordinary when we serve an extraordinary God. The very kind of famous quote which says, God does not require that we be successful, only that we be faithful. You might do this. You might go out and tell people about Jesus. You might fall flat on your face. Might be that people shout at you, or that you're stuck on a train with them for the next half an hour and you've got no way of getting out. But be faithful to him. Doesn't mean you have to be successful. Go out and tell the whole world what God's done in your life. One of my favorite psalms is Psalm 91. And the psalmist writes in here, it says, whoever dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. So when you go out and tell the whole world about Jesus, come back in. Come back into the shelter of the Most High. He is your refuge. He is your fortress. Come back to where your story started. And to finish off with this very, very tenuous link and this cliche, I'm sorry to keep going on about the hokey cokey, but it really is what it's all about. And to make it even more tenuous, it's a thing of like, you put your left foot in. God doesn't want your left foot. It's at the end of the bit where he says you put your whole self in. You put your whole self in, you put your whole self out. He doesn't want a part of you. He doesn't want your right hand. He doesn't want your left leg, your left foot, whatever it is. You put your whole self in. Then when you're refreshed and you're renewed and you're reinvigorated, then you put your whole self out. Put your whole self out into the world. And then you'll definitely shake it all about. Great.